The first time I visited the embassy, Sir Peter was kind enough to show me this seal, which was removed from the embassy door on the 3rd of September 1944 by the first party of officials as they arrived in Paris following the liberation. The seal was fixed to the embassy, to the entrance, in December 1941, advising that the building was under the protection of the Swiss consulate. Before December 1941, the embassy had been under the protection of the United States. When British officials entered these embassy buildings, they found them in surprisingly good repair. However, these rooms were filled to the ceiling with stored furniture belonging to diplomats' families who'd obviously left in a hurry in 1940. These rooms were packed with everything from pianos to hat stands, filled to the top. Officials began restoring the embassy to its functions, but not before searching for two things: the combination to the safes and listening equipment. They found the first, no signs of the second. As the letters from the economic advisor to Duff Cooper, John Gridley, describe, and you have the documents in your packs, and I'm very grateful for those documents today, the winter of 1944 was bitterly cold for the embassy staff. Conditions were very difficult and the heating barely adequate. A stark contrast to May 1940, when embassy staff started burning the archives, feeding them into the central heating system, which resulted in staff sweltering at their desks. The less secret papers were destroyed on large bonfires on the lawn. As Churchill arrived to meet with French leaders, the ambassador, Sir Ronald Campbell, prepared the embassy for evacuation, retaining only enough staff for essential duties. The embassy would remain as long as the French government remained. On the evening of June 10th, the ambassador and his staff left the courtyard in six cars, headed for Tours and then Bordeaux. In the ambassador's car was Oliver Harvey, minister at the embassy. Oliver Harvey would return to Paris as ambassador in 1948 until 1954, having spent the war as principal private secretary to the Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden. So on his return to Paris in 1948, would Harvey view France through the lens of 1940? To what extent did his experiences of 1940 and the Second World War create a certain expectations, inform his worldview, and shape his approach to Franco-British relations? The question is also relevant with respect to René Massilly, the other diplomat and ambassador I want to discuss today. René Massilly was Commissioner for Foreign Affairs to the Free French, who then became ambassador at London. Massilly's experience created a set of predispositions, a particular view of the French interest. That's why he was called and accepted to serve the Free French. And in a similar way, his experiences during the Second World War influenced his foreign policy outlook and informed his strategic vision. Before the Second World War, both Harvey and Massilly served their countries in various capacities, displaying considerable talent and resolve. During the war, of course, they had front row seats to the Churchill-De Gaulle relationship and witnessed Franco-British relations in times of crisis. They needed to manage these crises and prevent a breakdown in relations. The experience influenced their diplomatic methods in the shifting international landscape. When Oliver Harvey arrived in Paris in 1948, the Quai d'Orsay's head of protocol, Jacques Dumain, noted that Harvey looked clerical, for this term embraces both the civil servant and the ecclesiastic. Harvey's predecessor, Duff Cooper, thought that Harvey would make a respectable, if dull, ambassador. Both assessments were right. Harvey was well suited for the post. He had previous experience at the embassy and he had political capital due to his role next to Eden. But these very reasons had the potential to give him a negative view of France. As head of Chancery in the 1930s, minister from December 1939, Harvey witnessed the deteriorating political situation and the military collapse. Harvey observed with frustration the French political difficulties, and in his diaries he admonished the bad men of French politics. He condemned French leaders like Daladier for playing politics disgracefully and concluded that, and I quote, the French did not seem to have the will to fight. His appointment as ambassador at Paris also owed to his accrued political capital. During the war, as I say, he returned to act as Eden's private secretary, a position he fulfilled with unwavering loyalty and that's a loyalty Harvey did not always accord to his superiors, especially if he detected any sort of defeatist tendencies. Serving alongside Eden, Harvey witnessed the difficult relations between Churchill, de Gaulle, and Roosevelt. As one of the diplomats trying to prevent the various crises from escalating, Harvey described his frustrations with the general, describing him as vanity, ignorance, and lack of diplomacy, but these very failings are part of his strength. Harvey was equally frustrated with Churchill's behavior and criticized him for being as bad as Roosevelt in his unreasoning hatred of de Gaulle. Churchill's constant threats to break with de Gaulle and the American backing for General Giraud meant that relations continued to deteriorate. Harvey offered a realistic assessment. American misconceptions were dangerous. The level of support for de Gaulle in France could not be broken. Undermining the general would achieve nothing other than to turn sound French opinion against us. Whatever the American objectives and whatever the outcome, Britain would always need to work with its nearest neighbor. A break in relations would not be in the British interest. The experience of being caught between the charybdis of an obstinate general and the zeal of an equally inflexible prime minister led Harvey to a number of conclusions, and these are significant because they will continue to serve him. The first, that however difficult de Gaulle or the French may be to work with, it was in Britain's interest to maintain good relations with his closest neighbor. Britain must show benevolent support or risk accusations of sabotage. And third, the need to challenge abiding cultural predispositions on both sides. Now, it is significant to note that as ambassador, Harvey was often criticized by key figures at the Foreign Office for giving over-optimistic assessments of France. But perhaps one could argue that this optimism was calibrated. Harvey recognized France's economic weakness and fragmented nature of politics, but he was also aware of the Foreign Office's skepticism towards France. A recurrent theme in Foreign Office thinking was this tendency to question France's commitment to the West, to question France's capacity for political and economic recovery. So in his dispatches, Harvey tried to challenge these assumptions. He had to strike a balance between emphasizing the positive aspects of French recovery while at the same time conveying France's difficulties in a way that would elicit London's support rather than contempt. It would be unfair to say that Harvey was over-optimistic about France. In many instances, he was also critical of the French attitude. But Harvey felt that it was important to encourage France, not only because of France's internal weakness, but also because many French were suspicious, and they wouldn't stop in attributing any failures or setbacks to the lack of British support. So at times, his position was at odds with the inclination of many in the Foreign Office to attribute to France a general deep-rooted malaise. The following example is a sort of a typical response. It is beyond the bounds of credibility that a country which 9 short years ago had sunk so low, not only in the character of its government, but also in the general spirit of its people and armed forces, could have undergone a rebirth so utterly. Particularly when you remember that half of the intervening period was spent under the devastating moral influence of German occupation, French public life remains corrupt, self-seeking. 1/4 or 1/3 of the country is communist, few people pay their taxes, and the present government does not contain any outstanding national figure. Harvey came under criticism from permanent undersecretary, Sir William Strang, who felt that the experience of 2 world wars had broken France's spirit. There was no reason to think that she would be more resolute in 1950 than she was in 1939-40. Now, Harvey did not seek to change this mindset. He did not have the power to change opinion, but instead sought to grind away some of these abiding cultural predispositions. And there was some convergence. Strang did eventually agree with Harvey that Britain should go on sort of encouraging and fortifying. Harvey realized that the different mentality of the two countries would inevitably lead to misunderstandings and misinterpretations about each other's behavior. However, he suggested, quote, "We might well be advised to say occasionally rather more than we mean and to refrain from pouring cold water on other people's grandiose schemes merely because we do not see how they can be immediately realized." Abe's ambassadorship would see the emergence of conflicting Franco-British and French conceptions of European integration and European security, and two French initiatives particularly tested Harvey as an ambassador, the Schuman Plan Declaration of 1950 and the European Defense Union. With regards to the Schuman Plan, Harvey saw it as a bold, imaginative step, but again, he warned London that if we did not show support for the spirit behind the plan, Britain would be accused of trying to wreck it. Harvey saw the episode as a classic example of the difficulty of reconciling French Cartesianism with British empiricism, the French habit of proposing lofty aims and then thinking out the methods of achieving them, with the British habit of only advancing step by step. Harvey was once again trying to rectify cultural misunderstandings as well as methodological clashes. Now, the European defense community was a divisive issue, not only because it proposed a military contribution from the Federal Republic of Germany, but also because it planned this integration within a supranational framework. Harvey argued that London should not oppose the French initiative simply because of its federalist nature, but should show benevolent support. Britain, of course, did not become a member, but when the EDC ratification was in doubt due to the weight of political and military opposition to the project in France, the French government repeatedly requested Britain's close association to the project. Harvey and the embassy team focused on devising methods that would help the French with their domestic difficulties. And these efforts were influential. They were successful, they influenced thinking in London and contributed to a smoother transition when the EDC process collapsed. As he had done in previous crises, Harvey sought to limit the damage to Franco-British relations by offering support and preventing accusations of bad faith. Now I would like to turn my attention to René Meselly, who was Free French Commissioner for Foreign Affairs and an important figure in the negotiations between the General and the Ambassador. Following the liberation, Harvey served as ambassador at London until 1954. After 1954, he goes on to become Secretary General of the Quai d'Orsay. When Meselly left London in 54, he attended many receptions in his honor, and as a sign of the character of his mission, his round of farewell calls went beyond diplomatic protocol. When Meselly arrived in London in September 1944, protocol had also been set aside. At the time, Meselly could not present his papers to the king. The provisional government did not have formal recognition. Now, his critics have argued that during his ambassadorship, Meselly's views often corresponded far too closely with the British position. Meselly was also skeptical about the Schuman Plan and the European defense community. But I would argue that this criticism is misplaced. To understand the roots of his conviction and his opposition to French foreign policy, we need to look at the various factors that influenced Meselly's strategic vision, his experiences of the 1930s, and in particular the Second World War. René Meselly's considerable contribution to French diplomacy began during the First World War, and he played a significant role during the Paris Peace Conference. He was the German expert in the 1920s. He was influenced by Berthelot's diplomacy sought to maintain France's close collaboration with Great Britain, and he supported Briand's attempts to secure military and political alliance between the two countries. When French policy moved towards a multilateral security framework that would include Germany, Britain was still central to that security policy. In the 1930s, in his role as Assistant Director of Political Affairs, Meselly warned against German dominance, and he became one of the strongest opponents of France's policy towards Germany after March 1936. And his opposition to French policy became more pronounced after the Munich agreements of 1938, and that's when he is then sent as ambassador to Ankara. After June 1940, Meselly did not serve Vichy, but was in contact with a study group of former Quai d'Orsay officials connected to resistance activities. He was tolerated by Vichy, but attacked by the press. He was seen as an Anglophile, he was seen as anti-fascist for denouncing Munich. Now, in February 1943, he arrived in London to join de Gaulle and serve as Commissioner for Foreign Affairs. It was through Pierre Brossolette's intervention that Massilly arrived in London. It was important to surround de Gaulle with a range of political views and personalities that could curb some of his tendencies. Now, of course, as Commissioner for Foreign Affairs, Massilly was at the circumcenter of the de Gaulle-Churchill-Roosevelt triangle. And, of course, his diplomatic skills were tested, essentially presenting the diplomatic front de Gaulle could not present. In his memoirs, Massilly describes his rather thankless role of amortisseur. In Duff Cooper's diaries, Massilly is often described as being in the depths of despair. Francis Allies respected Massilly's considerable experience and his effort to bring a conciliatory attitude from de Gaulle during the general's many clashes with the Churchill and the Americans. Even when Anglo-French relations were particularly strained over the Levant, Massilly sought to exert careful pressure. So time after time, Massilly sought to diffuse tensions by warning his Anglo-American colleagues of the potential impact their actions would have on the general. And Massilly's efforts and his actions were noted, appreciated, and respected by his interlocutors. During the war, Massilly witnessed the value of cooperation with Great Britain and the United States, but the experience also reinforced within him a deep distrust of the United States. Massilly was involved in drafting the documents the committee would use in negotiations with General Churchill. Massilly recognized France's relative weakness, and this contributed to his assessment that France's national resurgence was predicated on a closer understanding with Great Britain. So to this end, his appointment in London suited Massilly well. He had a good contact with many at the Foreign Office, and as I say, his effort had been appreciated. A number of issues would test Anglo-French relations, and Massilly's efforts were to overcome these underlying constraints. He had to overcome sort of France's relative weakness, and he had to challenge sort of these Foreign Office assumptions about France viewed through the lens of 1940. In Massilly's worldview, European reconstruction could only begin if France and Britain joined forces to provide security against a resurgent Germany or expanding Soviet Union. So the proposals for a coal and steel community and the European defense community, of course, then challenge his worldview. And his essential skepticism about them then turns to outright opposition. And twice he offered to resign. Now, the lack of British participation goes some way to account for Massilly's opposition, but not fully. Massilly can indeed be described as one of the strongest proponents of Franco-British cooperation, but his underlying motives go beyond any pro-British leanings. I think the key factor in Massilly's conception of French security. And this view is rooted in his experiences of the 1930s, the Second World War, which obviously envisages Britain firmly attached to the continent. Now, his emphasis on British involvement in European security did not translate into automatic agreement with British policy, in particular if that policy undermined French interests. It's Massilly's preoccupation with the future of Germany that would override any Anglophile tendencies he may have had. Massilly was often critical of French politicians, but he was equally frustrated with London's reluctance to appreciate France's predicament. Massilly's vigorous attempts to challenge the Foreign Office assumptions led many officials in London to wonder why Paris considered him such an Anglophile. So in this end, his reservations about the EDC resonated in Paris. They influenced senior Quai d'Orsay officials, and they were crucial to the eventual outcome. Now, if I can say a few words to conclude. Oliver Harvey were in many respects traditional diplomats who showed great determination during some of the country's most difficult periods. And Massilly's perception of the failures and humiliations of the 1930s had an impact on his outlook. And this British intransigence and the failure to join forces in the 1930s was something that should never be repeated. Oliver Harvey was scrupulous in his assessment of French motives. He sought to explain French fears, and when they clashed, he urged patience and support in order to keep Western unity, meet French sensibilities, and avoid accusations of bad faith. Although he faced criticism from some officials back home, viewed in retrospect, his approach was quite intelligent and broad and quite enlightened. Surveying his time in Paris, Harvey offered a few thoughts. He said, Anglo-French relations, like Anglo-American relations, can never be taken for granted, but require constant attention. Our interests touch, for good or bad, in too many ways and places. The price we must pay for cooperation in Western Europe, where France is vital to us, is in attention to France's interests and susceptibilities, however tiresome, pretentious, or outdated they may be. Harvey and Massilly both played an important role during the Second World War, and with this accrued political capital, they sought to maintain close bilateral relationships, even in times of crisis between the two countries. And even if after 1944 there was discord between the two countries, they had recovered from the dark days of 1940.